Hello, welcome to Fly Fishing Tales. I'm John Howard. When I decided to collect together these stories from eminent fishermen, I rather suspected they'd all have good tales to tell, and so it's turned out. What you're going to hear is our featured fishermen talking just as they would at the end of a day on the water, along with the sounds of wildlife and the evocative rattle of reels. On this side, William Daniels recalls the delights of a day on one of our most famous stillwater fisheries, Blagdon Lake. Dave Steffi, in complete contrast, is fishing in the Henry's Fork area of the Snake River in the US. But we start with Peter Lapsley, a lifelong angler who writes regularly on fly fishing and has written several successful books on the subject, including the J.R. Hartley volumes.
If I was going to give the story a title, I would call it Relativity. It has to do with a particularly lovely inn to which we used to go for, roughly speaking, the last week of May, the first week in June every year, right through the 1980s. Lovely inn. And inn is a much underused word in the British language, because an inn is, I suppose, a pub that thinks it's an hotel, or an hotel that thinks it's a pub. And if you get the balance right, it makes for a wonderful blend. And this particular one was all the things that an inn should be. The bedrooms were comfortable, it had great big deep old Victorian bars, and the hot water came bursting out of the taps. And the food was superb. It was a gastronomic campaign. It'd be a dietitian's nightmare, because the milk came out in great globs from the jug in the morning onto your cereal. And you always had a terrible argument with Benji as to whether you were going to have two eggs or three, and he wanted one, and things like that. But it was just marvellous. It was a fabulous place. And they have about 9 miles of fishing on a particularly pretty river. It's just a stunning river. It's absolutely beautiful. And so we used to go down there every year. And I don't remember whether it was in the second or the third year that we started going down there, that I was on a particular beat just below the Old Iron Bridge, where there's a very steep curve in the river. And on the inside of the bend, typically, there's a sort of shingle beach. And on the far side, the river had carved away the bank. So it was actually a sort of cliff, not very high, perhaps 8 feet high, but a really quite remarkable cliff. And growing out of it in the way that they do was this hawthorn bush. And the hawthorn bush, big hawthorn bush, and its branches were trailing almost to the water. They didn't quite reach the water, but very nearly so. And as I approached it from downstream, moving upstream towards it, I saw this huge pulsing ripple coming out from underneath the hawthorn tree. And it appeared to be a fish that was bigger than the average for the river. It didn't seem necessarily very exceptional, but it was lying an impossible lie, or a very nearly impossible lie. In order to get a dry fly to it, you needed to chuck the dry fly upstream of the hawthorn bush. So it would drift down for probably 8 feet until it reached the point at which the fish was feeding. And as you cast across the current, of course, the current in the middle of the stream is always more powerful than the current on the edges. And so the current would grab the belly of the line and whip it downstream, and that would skid the fly across the surface, producing drag. And drag, of course, is the absolute enemy of the dry fly fisher. Most people realise that if the fly is actually skidding across the surface, on the whole, the trout won't take it. But even when it appears to be sitting there, drifting down entirely natural of the current, just the slightest amount of drag, the slight pressure of the leader pulling on the fly, can just create something. I don't believe fish are intelligent. I don't believe they say, oh, good heavens, that fly is dragging, therefore it's an artificial, and therefore I won't take it. All I think that happens is that it doesn't trigger the feeding response. It doesn't look like a fly to them, because it's dragging and flies don't. So it was a very difficult cast. And I approached it very carefully, and I tied on what I would regard as the ideal fly in those circumstances on that particular river, which is the little blue upright. And I was using a little brook rod, a little cane brook rod, 7 foot, with a 5-weight line, I suppose, and about a 9-foot leader, tapered quite a light point, down to about 2 pounds. And cast to this fish, cast upstream of the hawthorn. And all that really happened was that my worst fears were realised, because every time it came down underneath, just before it got to where the fish was rising, the fly would just skid off to the side and nothing happened. There was no take. And throughout that holiday, I kept on going back, because I love those sort of challenges. That's just very difficult, and I didn't know how to solve it. There was no way you could tackle it from the other bank because of the cliff. There was no way in which you could wade in and cast straight up to it because the water was too deep. In every possible way, it was an impossible fish. But I kept on going back, and in fact, on one occasion, just before the end of the holiday, I did actually rise him. He did actually come up to it. He didn't take it. He just nosed it and turned over, and away he went. And the following year when we went back there, I'd become quite besotted with this fish. It wasn't so much the fish itself, but it was the lie that was interesting. It was a very good lie. And so the next year I went back, and sure enough, there underneath this hawthorn tree was a fish rising again. I guess it was probably the same one, no reason why it shouldn't have been. And went through the same rituals again with the same tackle and the same flies and tried a whole variety of flies as I had the previous year after the blue upright. I tried a beacon beige and I tried, I suppose, a Tupson dispensable, perhaps a black gnat. Those sorts of things are fairly obvious things at the back end of June or back end of May or beginning of June. And exactly the same result. And throughout the holiday I laid siege to this stupid fish, feeling sillier and sillier myself, until eventually I had to give it best and drive home. And that autumn, it didn't actually have anything very much to do with the fish. I certainly didn't go searching it out because of the fish, but I reread Vincent Marinaro's wonderful book, In the Ring of the Rise. Anybody who hasn't read it must read it, because it is the most wonderful expose on the realities of dry fly fishing. And I reread that chapter of his about the puddle cast, which is an extraordinary technique. And so I went out in the garden on several days through that winter and tried it. And essentially it consists of, instead of punching the line forward on the forward cast, wafting it forward just as if it was another false cast, and also aiming it high. So you aim it 15, 20, 25 degrees above the horizontal. So it'll arrive above the water and slowly. And the key to success with it, he said, was to get the fly line to be dropping before the fly had overtaken the tip of it. So I tried that and kept on doing it in the garden and developing it and getting it better. And better is a pretty relative word here, because it looks awful and it feels awful. And on grass, it is awful. What happens is that the fly line drops and the leader then crumples down onto the end of the fly line in a heap with the fly on top of it. But he said it worked. And we went back to the hotel or to the inn the following year, the back end of May. And I couldn't wait to get onto this particular beat, because I had actually got this fish fairly firmly in mind, and approached it. And to start with, when first I went there, there was nothing happening. It wasn't a rise of any sort. And I sat on the shingle bank for a while. And suddenly there it was, this pulsing rise from underneath the hawthorn tree. And so I put on a brand new blue upright and oiled it very carefully and made check the leader and so on. And pulled some line out onto the bank. This is something which I think a lot of people don't do. Most people seem to extend line when they're false casting. You see people false casting endlessly pulling line off the reel. The trick to success, in fact, and one of the tricks to success in dry fly fishing, is to pull the line off onto the ground before you start, get it sorted out so it's not going to tangle when you start casting, and then you can actually aerialize the line with about two false casts and drop it. That avoids frightening the fish, because the fly line going backwards and forwards across the water does frighten fish. There's no doubt about that. So I got it all sorted out. And I did this puddle cast, the famous Marinaro puddle cast, to a point immediately above the hawthorn bush. And it was the most extraordinary sensation. The fly line dropped onto the water. The leader collapsed in heap on the end of the fly line. And then, as if with a will of its own, the fly detached itself and drifted down across the water with no drag at all, the leader unravelling as it went, and it fetched up over the fish. And there was this wonderfully satisfying glop, and I rose and it was struck and hooked it, and it bored off downstream, fizzing around the pool, trying to bore its way into some alder roots. Clearly a very strong fish indeed. And eventually I got it under control and slid it over the net and laid it out on the gravel bank. And there was that awful dilemma as to whether you kill this fish or return it. It was stunning. It was the most beautiful fish. It was huge. It was a beautiful, soft, buttery golden colour. It had the most wonderful little black markings on it. Its fins were translucent and pin sharp, and it was just an utterly lovely fish. And the judgment that I took was not one, I think, perhaps, of the trophy hunter. It was a pragmatic decision that actually it was exhausted, this fish. I think we were both exhausted. And that if I returned it to the water, the probability was that it wouldn't survive. So with some reluctance and feeling a little guilty, I tapped it on the head. I took the hook out of its mouth, and I got out my scales, and I put the hook of the scales into the gill cover, lifted the fish up, and the scales said 1 pound, 2 ounces. And it was indeed a monster, because this was the little Torridge in Devon. And the wild brown trout there run at 3 or 4 to the pound, and a 12-ounce fish is a whopper. And a 1 pound, 2 ounce fish is just unbelievable.
Henry's Fork area, Henry's Fork of the Snake River, which is southeastern Idaho. It's western United States. Guy that I've known for a number of years, used to fish with a lot in Montana or down into Silver Creek, another famous area, but we never had gone to the Henry's Fork. So we scheduled a trip, well, we call it a BR trip, which means it was before Redford's movie. It was after Redford's movie. The river runs through it. There's so many more fishermen out west that it got a bit too crowded. So we classify all of our fishing trips as BR or AR, after Redford or before Redford. Anyway, the year before Redford. The river itself has sometimes two or three or four different insects hatching, prolific hatches. It's on Harriman Ranch, which was, Abel Harriman was the originator of most of the western U.S. railway systems. And he had a huge chunk of land in that part of Idaho. He donated it to a nature conservancy as long as they would leave it as it is. As an example, that morning, that first morning we fished, we had to move out of the river because a cow moose and her young calf came down, and she was not the least bit interested in giving us any room whatsoever. She came walking at us, snorting. So we changed holes. We did. We moved. We got to the Harriman section on the first morning, and we were told that the hatch started at about 9:30. It's a Betis hatch, small, size 18, olive, basically. We hardly had a chance to fish. We were laughing so hard before we even got to the river. You have to park about a mile away from it. Harry and I decided not to put on our wading stuff and walk that mile. So we were carrying it just over our shoulders, the waders in boots over our shoulders with the rods already put up. We got about halfway down. We turned around and looked back at the path. And coming behind us was six men, already in their neoprene waders, green ones, and they were all riding small fold-up bicycles. It looked like Kermit the Frog as they were all coming at us down this trail. It looked absolutely ridiculous. We finally get to the river about 9 o'clock, expecting the hatch any moment. And the hatch, we were told by these guys, the little Kermit the Frog men, as they went by us, the hatch would start at 9:15, so we got down, they better pick our place quick. What they didn't know about, and they failed to tell us, was at 9:10 the wind started to blow a gale, which was absolutely impossible to fish. The fish were there, and you could see rises all over the place by 9:30. And there were insects all through the air, but you couldn't possibly cast. You could throw a short line, but you couldn't get near a fish that way. You had to throw 35 feet or so. And these fish don't move. They've got one station each one of them sits at. And there's so many insects, they don't have to move. So it would take a perfect cast over an individual fish to get the right drift to catch fish. Well, after 10 or 15 minutes of leaders flip-flopping all over in the breeze, and they're, you know, size, they're 6X or 7X, so they're 2-3 pound breaking strength leaders. We decided we'd try another place. Went back and had a late breakfast, chatted it at one of the fishing shops, and they said, oh, try Box Canyon. Box Canyon's good, it's not too bad. Nymphing down there, though, no dry flies. Don't expect any dry flies. We shouldn't have stopped for breakfast because Kermit Frog Society had figured the same thing out. And as we got down to Box Canyon, there they were, except now they look like nymphing herons because they'd switched into wearing those Lefty Cray-style big brim hats, long nose, long back, so they wouldn't blow off in the wind. So there wasn't much going on down there either. There wasn't a lot of room. Wind still did bother you, and we didn't do very well, which is another way of saying we only caught two fish. They weren't very big ones either. We went back to the camper that night at Henry's Lake. Well, we sat down with, admittedly, two very large whiskeys, trying to figure out what we were going to do for the rest of the week, because if that wind was going to come up all week, we were going to be sunk. Harry brought along a bunch of books about fishing in the West, and he had one that was particular to fishing in the Henry's Fork Lake area. And just thumbing through that book, there was one little paragraph that said, after a winter of a lot of snow, you might try the fingers on Island Pond Reservoir. Oh. Well, here, it was a big snow winter before that. Some places a record, so there should have been plenty of meltwater. I also said it was good for float tubes, and we'd thrown the float tubes in the back of the Harry's pickup. So we decided that's what we'd do the next morning. So we drove up to Island Pond Reservoir, which is in the same general area, and picked a finger. There's about 12 of these fingers. The fingers, in fact, are drainages. The reservoir is, in fact, an old stream valley. And then the little drainages that moved into that major drainage basin, that's what they call the fingers. And when the reservoir goes high in the spring, there's water in them. I guess one of them might have been up to half a mile long, and there are maybe 75 to 200 meters across. The flies that we were told to use, in fact, they said there was only one fly to use. It's a Halloween fly was the name of it. It's a woolly bugger, but it has an orange and black body, black hackle, palmered, and a silver rib to hold it down, darkish to black tail on it. It's a leech imitation because there's a lot of leeches in this lake. So we got down and started to fish. There were a number of rises on these fingers. Right? We looked in the air, and if you're used to fishing in the western U.S., there's this really nice insect that likes rivers but also likes still waters. It's Calabatus. It's about a size 14 speckled wing. It looks quite a bit like an olive, except that it has slightly grayer body and it has speckly wings. We could see them hatching. We had some patterns, but we didn't manage to turn any fish. So we went back to the great Halloween fly. We couldn't have been fishing the Halloween fly more than 10 or 15 minutes when I hear Harry, expletive deleted, yelling as this fish was porpoising across the water in front of him. 24, if I remember, about 24-inch rainbow, about 5.5 or 6 pounds. Well, I hadn't been fishing much that year, so at that particular point, I was rather excited about catching fish. And I proceeded that day to break off 6 trout. I didn't proceed to release any purposefully. I broke off 6 trout that day. The fly itself, however, worked very well. Next day, we decided to do the same thing because it was, again, windy. It was windy when we woke up and a bit gray and nasty as well. Picked a different finger, did the same thing again. Harry caught 4 or 5 fish. I don't remember how many. Nothing was smaller than 20 inches. One of them probably was close to 8 pounds. And I basically had the same day again. I kept breaking fish off. Well, that became even worse because we went in for lunch, and we were excited about getting back on it, so I hadn't finished my second Diet Coke. And so I got in the float tube, and I stuck it between my legs, and I figured, oh, as we kick our way out, we'll fish the fly, but there's not usually very much until we got a couple hundred yards away from the very head of these things. Right? So I flicked the fly in the water and let it sink down. It was trolling this thing with a Coke sitting between my legs. As I reached down to grab the Coke for one of the last sips, what happens? Fish. Coke can flies in the air. I lose it, try to grab it, let go of the rod. Rod falls in the water. I reach down and get the rod, lost the fish. And I never had a hit the rest of the day. At the end of the second day on the fingers, Harry and I decided that since we'd come all the way to fish the Henry's Fork of the Snake River, that we'd spend the rest of the time doing that. So Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we effectively pounded the river. And it was pretty good to us, actually. The wind didn't come up too bad. We hit a nice hatch of betas, caught several fish between us. That particular area, Henry's Fork of the Snake, you couldn't find better fishing in North America, I don't believe, outside of possibly Alaska. The reservoirs and Henry's Lake has cutthroat rainbow crosses. And there are a few brown trout around, but you rarely hear of anybody catching the browns. It does get a bit crowded at certain times of the year, especially mid-June to mid-July, because there's a stonefly hatch, big insect of about size 4. But it's a wonderful place to go fishing. Guide service, if you can afford it, but you don't really need a guide. Just hit a couple of the fishing shops and ask for a few ideas, especially on flies and what's hatching. They'll quite happily give you advice and probably want you to buy a t-shirt and a few flies, but other than that, they're very friendly.
Blagdon was the first of the big stocked stillwater fisheries. When Bristol Waterworks dammed the River Yeo about the turn of the century, they didn't have any idea quite what spectacular trout fishing it was. It wasn't done for the trout fishing, but then they suddenly discovered that the water was so rich in food that the fingerlings and fry that they put in there grew so rapidly. And I think the first fish that was caught in Blagdon weighed, it was opening day, 1904, and the first fish that came out was over 5 pounds. And I think in the early years, that was a fairly typical fish. They had one year when the average weight of the fish was over 5 pounds. So it was quite staggering, and you can imagine why people came from all over the world to fish this spectacular lake. But what really appeals to me about Blagdon is this idea that when you go there, you're treading in the footsteps of the famous. Anyone who is or was anybody in the world of fishing had to go and fish at Blagdon. And if you look through all the classic fishing books, you find that Blagdon, there's either a chapter on it, or if you look it up in the index, there'll be just masses of references to it throughout. And even Halford, who is associated with chalk streams and the dry fly, he went down and fished at Blagdon. The best known figure was Dr. Bell, who there's still a square in Blagdon village itself called Bell Square, which is presumably where Dr. Bell had his surgery. During the First World War, he had terrible experiences at Passchendaele, and apparently he was a very morose, lugubrious man who never spoke to anybody. And he would go and stand for hours and hours down by the lake and studied the insect life. He worked out that the trout were feeding on certain insects, and if he could create satisfactory imitations of those insects, then surely he would stand a better chance than just trolling some fly that looked like a cockerel through the water. And a lot of his flies are still used today. Bell's Amber Nymph, which is still a very good imitation of the sedge pupa. Because of his success with these flies, the word spread and they started to be used on other lakes. And so in that sense, Blagdon is very important to everybody who fishes on lakes and reservoirs today. The first thing that you notice about Blagdon is how incredibly beautiful it is. Although it's man-made, it looks too good to be man-made. The only evidence that it's man-made is that there's a dam at one end of it. Off the far end of the dam, it leads onto a bay called Butcombe Bay, which has to be one of my favourite spots. It's like a little lake within itself, and it has little bays that run off it. And if the wind's in the right direction, you can drift a boat right the way across it and into one of these little inlets on the far side of it. And I have one particular memory of fishing there. I suppose this must have been mid to late 80s. And it was when the dry fly, stillwater dry fly as we know it now, was still very much being developed. And I had various friends who told me that you could catch trout on little bits of seal fur just dubbed onto a hook with a little bit of hackle wrapped round the end of it, perhaps the bottom of it clipped off so they sat down in the surface film. And an old friend of mine, with whom I still fish regularly, we'd booked up our day, a June day, on Blagdon, and still, to get a weekend boat on Blagdon, you have to book it right at the start of the year. And it was a beautiful, slightly cloudy day with a gentle ripple, and the lake looked beautiful. We set off on a drift across Butcombe Bay, and the ripple, I suppose, was about 2 inches high. We were fishing, obviously, with floating lines, and the rod I always use for this kind of fishing is a 9'6" Sage RPL, which is a fast-action rod. We had 3 dry flies, a bob fly, 1 dropper, and a point fly. The flies are always very similar. Typical selection would be probably a bristle hopper on the point and perhaps something a bit bushier on the top dropper. And on the middle dropper, the fly I was using at the time was just a piece of claret seal's fur with a red hackle wound round the front of it, probably on a size 14 hook. It's a fly that's generically known as a Bits, Bob's Bits, and it was developed in the Midlands at about that time by Bob Watts. As we drifted across this beautiful bay, the ideal thing when you're dry fly fishing is to see a fish show more than once. And a fish moved on our right, perhaps 50 yards away, and then it showed again 40 yards away, and then it showed again 30 yards away. When you have a fish like this, you know exactly it's on a line, it's going to come straight across you, and what you do is you lay your flies out as an ambush for it. So it has to swim past your 3 flies. So the two of us both saw this fish coming. It was coming from the right-hand side across the front of the drifting boat, and I was on that end of the boat, and Mark was obviously the other end. So theoretically, it was my fish. I laid the fly line out, perhaps 20 yards in front of the boat, and I can remember it clearly as anything. The three flies just dropped on the water, bop, 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 tiny little circle, and the leader, of course, was degreased. Very important when fishing dry flies on still water to degrease the leader so it sinks. And the flies were sitting there absolutely perfectly. The fish had just shown perhaps 10 yards to the right of me, and I knew that roughly where my middle dropper was, it was going to pop up and eat it. The last time it had risen, I'd got an idea of just how big this fish was, because when fish are feeding on buzzers, their dorsal fin first comes out of the water, and then you see the tail just slowly lift out of the water and go down. And this fish obviously had a very large tail on it. It was not a recently stocked fish. It was something that had been in there for a long time. The tension was mounting, and we knew that any second now, if it was going to show again, it was going to happen right in front of us. And at that moment, the fish just rolled over my middle dropper fly and turned down with it. Obviously, you have to pause before you hit the fish. I waited for a split second, lifted the rod, and the flies just came straight back to me. I hadn't touched the fish at all. Of course, the next place that the fish was likely to rise, I hadn't touched it. The next place it was likely to rise was 10 yards to the left of my middle dropper, which happened to be where Mark's middle dropper was. So I suppose about 15 seconds later, the fish just rolled over his middle dropper, which was a similar fly to mine. And of course, he hooked the fish, at which point all hell broke loose. It dragged the rod tip down as it set off on a straight run to the far end of Butcombe Bay. I suppose after 30 or 40 yards of backing had been ripped through the rings, it then leapt into the air. And we saw this huge rainbow trout. The sun caught the flanks of it as it leapt, and then it crashed back into the water. And after a long battle, he eventually got the fish in, and it was a 5.5-pound rainbow trout. I think that's the best fish I've ever seen from Blagdon. It was just fin perfect. It was a solid muscle. It's moments like that you never forget. They just linger in the memory, and I can remember it as clearly now as the day it happened. We were in the most beautiful place you could imagine on a day when the weather was absolutely perfect for it, and ultimately we got the fish in the boat, and it was hugely exciting. The fact that it missed my fly almost made it more exciting when eventually we got it. So that was a great fish.